Today, we will be beginning a new series in Exodus. Last winter, we did a series through Leviticus, and I referenced Exodus so many times and alluded to a lot of stuff in there and kind of even expanded on some of the stuff. I just figured we might as well, this winter, go do Exodus so we can spend more time on that, because there was so much more that I wanted to talk about but didn't have time, and also what would have been distracting because the point of last winter was Leviticus, so we're going to work through Exodus this year. The Exodus theme also works very nicely for a series beginning the first week of December in the Christmas season, because the Exodus theme, this theme of deliverance, this theme of salvation, this theme of release from bondage, works very nicely into Christmas, the time that we celebrate the birth of Jesus, our Savior and Deliverer from the bondage of sin and death. I think we are all going to be generally a bit more familiar with the events of Exodus than we were with Leviticus, at least the narrative portion. I think that probably a lot of us have seen movies such as Prince of Egypt or The Ten Commandments or other movies that have focused on the Exodus theme, which, by the way, I will be doing side notes once in a while. Sorry to spoiler alert some of those movies. I'm assuming a lot of us have seen them. But because they're generally familiar with the wide Christian audience, I am going to point out at times where they are taking liberties, and they're a movie. They're going to take liberties. There's nothing wrong with that. I love The Prince of Egypt. I love the Ten Commandments movie, so I'm not bashing them. I'm just helping us to try to follow the actual flow of the storyline and just realize that at time artistic liberties have been taken, which this week is kind of sad for me because one of my favorite parts of The Prince of Egypt is not exactly how it is in the Bible. So I was studying, I'm like, oh, well, it's still beautiful in the movie, but it's not quite how it happened. Yeah, exactly. So we'll get there. All that to say, we are, I'm assuming, generally more familiar with this. And honestly, because of that as well, and also just due to the fact that I don't want this series to just go for 3 years, because Exodus is a long book, we will be working fairly quickly through the material. And because of that, I do not have time to camp on every verse and every concept and every person and every place and every question. So please, as we're going, be writing down or remembering or even sending me right away questions from each series or from each sermon, from each chapter or whatever. As I was prepping for this sermon, I wrote down two of my own questions because I'm like, I wish I had time to talk about that, but I don't, because it's just going to be distracting from the main point of this sermon. It's something that's really cool and I would love to talk about it. So I will be compiling my own list, and then feel free to send me questions as well. Because I'm sure in a book this size, there is going to be a lot of questions potentially that I will not address, and I apologize in advance. And if I don't address something, it is honestly really mostly just because it doesn't directly feed into the theme that I'm trying to hit on that sermon. It's not that it's not a good question. And my goal with this series specifically is actually very similar to, thank you, is actually very similar to Leviticus. Leviticus was a very unfamiliar book, and a book that there's a lot of stuff in it that we're like, is this even relevant? I don't understand this. There seems to be a lot of cultural stuff going on here. So I try to walk us through some of that and give us helpful tools to enable us to be able to read Leviticus. Similar to that in the book of Exodus, there are sections in Exodus that we get to them and we're just like, okay, skip. Or we just kind of skim through because, like, out of duty, and like we just don't really understand it or don't really honestly care. Like, there's the description of how to build everything in the tabernacle, and then the last few chapters, there's a very, very similar description that they did build the things in the tabernacle. There are actually a lot of really cool points of theology that you get if you actually slow down and pay attention and dig into some of the background information of what's going on there, even down to the differences between the description of how to build it and then the description of how it's built. Things are rearranged and reworded in ways that are actually trying to teach something. So, which really just proves the point that the stuff in the Bible that, like, is weird or just seems, like, random, like, you should probably honestly just pause there and dig in, because the weird stuff usually is pretty important. So I'm gonna hope in this series, just like Leviticus, to equip us and give us some foundations and building blocks to even be able to dig into those sections as well. So you will notice in that I may pause and even spend an entire sermon sometimes on things that you're like, why? Like, we are actually going to spend an entire sermon on furniture. which I know Caleb would be super excited about. So hopefully you guys get excited. I'm not going to promise excitement, but my hope with this is that just as my understanding and appreciation for Exodus and even the furniture and even random things in Exodus has been greatly enriched through my study, I'm hoping to impart at least a part of that to you, where even if you're not excited about it, you're at least equipped to know that it is there for a reason and that there is something that we can learn from it. There isn't a single part of the Bible that you should just rip out because you don't like it or it doesn't make sense. It just means you might need to do a little bit of work and ask some questions and try to dig into what's going on. So that's, just like Leviticus, one of my goals with this series. Before we start digging into Exodus, we need to see how the book as a whole fits in the story of the Bible. And Caleb kind of stole some of my thunder with this because he just worked through Adam to Abraham in Sunday school. But I'm going to be framing it in a slightly different way. And I am kind of tipping my hand on kind of the theme of the whole series with how I'm going to be framing where Exodus fits into the Bible. I did that with Leviticus, by the way, if you're paying attention to the beginning of that one. But as far as like where Exodus, the book, and the events of the book fit into the scope of the biblical story, Genesis 1 and 2 opens with creation and Adam and Eve in the presence of God enjoying fellowship with him. Then in chapter 3, you have the fall, or the entrance of sin into the world, and Adam and Eve are expelled from the presence of God. The effects of sin continue to corrupt mankind until in chapters 6 through 9, God sends a flood to destroy everyone except the faithful Noah and his family. By the end of chapter 9, however, we see the effects of sin and the curse even in Noah's children. By chapter 11, all of Noah's descendants disobey God's command to multiply and spread throughout the earth and instead gather and try to build a tower to make a name for themselves. God puts an end to this by confusing their languages and causing them to scatter throughout the earth. We have quickly gone from two people in God's presence in Eden, his created temple, who were expelled, to a lot of people creating their own temple for their own purposes and also being expelled. In chapter 12 of Genesis, we see God call out from these now scattered people one couple, Abram and Sarai, to be his covenant people. In contrast to the people trying to make a name for themselves at Babel, God promised that he would make Abram's name great and bless the whole world through him. In fact, God changed his name to Abraham, which means father of a multitude. We see God actively present and involved in Abraham's life throughout the next few chapters, and Abraham is given a promise that God will give him the land of Canaan and be present with his descendants there. In this book, we see his descendants as they await the fulfillment of these promises through the line of Isaac and then Jacob until they must flee into the land of Egypt, where they are held in bondage for 400 years, just as God had told Abraham would happen. As we read the end of Genesis, though, that Bruce read for us, we see and explain to us that what seemed like a bad thing, going down to Egypt because of a famine, God meant for good, quote, that many people should be kept alive, as we heard in Genesis 50, verse 20. He had used Joseph's time in Egypt, even though his brothers had meant it for harm, he had used Joseph's time there to prepare the way for God's people to be preserved in the land. The book of Genesis closes with a promise that God, promise from God through Joseph, that God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. God will not forget them. He was with them on their journey down to the land. He will not abandon them in the land. And he will be with them and bring them on a journey out of the land again. In Exodus, we see this promise fulfilled. Just as God used Joseph to deliver the people from a famine and bring them into Egypt, so God now uses Moses to deliver the people from slavery through dramatic demonstrations of God's power and lead them out of the land. This is part of Exodus that we're all very familiar with. Along the way, they stop at Mount Sinai, where God makes a covenant with the people and gives them laws to follow as his people. They agree to follow these laws and be in covenant with God. But when Moses is gone for a long time getting all the laws, the people have Aaron make a golden calf and worship it. They default back to the form of worship that they had known. We'll get there, but they may even have thought that worshiping God in this way was a good way to worship him, but he was angry because they were trying to worship him on their own terms, for their own purposes, and contrary to how he had commanded them to. Notice that this episode in Exodus interrupts the flow of instructions from God for building the tabernacle, or a place of worship as he instructs. And immediately after this, it is clarified that at this time, God only met with Moses on the top of Mount Sinai and in the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. This was for the people's own protection. God then renews the covenant and promises to be with the people as they go towards the promised land. In chapter 35, Moses gives the people the instructions he received for the building of the tabernacle so that the tent of meeting can be inside the camp. Exodus ends with the completion of the tabernacle complex and the resting of the presence of God within the camp to be with them on their journey. At the very end of the book, we read in the last few verses, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and the fire was on it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys." The presence, the glory of the God, or the glory of God, now rested in the midst of the people. The very people who had just violated the terms of the covenant that they had just agreed to. God is now more visibly than ever with his people, just as he had always been with them, even when it didn't seem like he was. In Exodus, then, we see a God who keeps his promises. Despite difficulties, despite hardships, despite how dark times look, and despite the failings of his own people, we see a God who keeps his promises. He had made a covenant to Abraham, and he kept this covenant. He delivered his people in their time of need. He was their God. He is their God. He is our God. He's with them. He's with us. It is a story of deliverance. It is a story of a God who keeps his covenants and who never abandons his people. So today, as we begin this story, we will be looking at Exodus 1:1 through 2:10. In this beginning section, we will see the need for and the birth of a deliverer. So I'm going to read the first 7 verses as we get started looking at the beginning of Exodus. "These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. When Joseph died and all his brothers and all that generation, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." We see in these first few verses a continuation from the end of Genesis, where we see promises from God through Joseph and earlier in the book to Jacob, that God would be with the people and that they would increase there and that one day he would bring them out of the land. This seems to be going pretty well so far. We see, in short, that the people are increasing in these first 7 verses. They are not in the promised land, but God is fulfilling his promise to Abraham that his descendants would be countless as the stars. In verse 5, we are told that the direct descendants of Jacob numbered 70 when he came down to Egypt. This itself, by the way, is an important number. And notice what I clarify there, that this is the direct descendants. This is actually just a subgroup of the people. There are more than 70. But the 70 that are being keyed in on are the direct descendants of Jacob. What is interesting about it is that numbers throughout the Bible have a lot of meaning. And the number 70 might feel kind of random or just feel kind of informative. But if you think about it in the flow of what's happening here, the beginning of the book of Exodus, that we know what's going to happen, the number 70, 7 symbolizes perfection, and 10 symbolizes completion. So you put them together, and that is a number of hope. It is a number of hope that God is fulfilling his promise and multiplying the people. And then this is followed immediately by, in verse 7, it says, "But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." Man, that sounds a lot like other places in Genesis about be fruitful and multiply and spread abroad. This seems like God is really keeping his promises. So you have a symbolic, not literal and symbolic, number 70. And then you have all of this language here from Genesis. Right off the bat, we have this very thematic and very purposeful wording to purposely bring our minds back to the God who is continuing to keep his promises. And then you get to verses 8 through 22. And we're going to see that from this beginning of hope and seeming fulfillment of promise, things go downhill quite quickly. Throughout the rest of the chapter, from the people being subjected to hard labor all the way to the command that every newborn son be thrown into the Nile. As we read verses 8 through 22, I'm going to key in on a few different things. I'm going to read the whole section first. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they sent taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this, and let the male children live?" The midwife said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." In the first 7 verses, you have an opening of hope and a fulfillment of promise. And then by the end of the chapter, especially the first-time reader, we'll see what's going on and ask, is God still going to keep his promise? We've gone downhill very fast and this doesn't look good. How is God going to still keep his promise? We've gone from people multiplying and spreading abroad to every male son. Nah, that's redundant. Every son being thrown into the Nile. The first thing I want to consider as we look at this second half of chapter 1, before we get into God's answer, some of the things going on in this chapter. The first one is the nature of the slavery of the people. Between what we have in Exodus and the accounts of forced labor in Egyptian documents, it seems that the Hebrew men were conscripted by Pharaoh to perform forced labor under brutal and demanding and degrading conditions, and given little compensation for their labor. They still lived in their own houses and towns and were allowed to keep their family units intact, and some were apparently even neighbors with the Egyptians, but they were looked on as a threat that had to be discouraged and beaten down through brutal forced labor. That they lived in their own houses and towns is explicitly pointed out in chapter 8, where we see that they are still living in Goshen, and that it is said to be where people, God's people dwell as opposed to where the Egyptians dwell. This explains why and how the sheltering and the separation of the Israelites and the Egyptians from the effects of the plague was very evident. And then it also explains how Moses' mother was able to keep him hidden for 3 months. In short, they were residents who had been in the land for quite a while at this point, but were subjugated and attempted to be discouraged and beaten down through forced labor and unfair treatment. Keep this in mind later when God talks to his people about how to treat residents and sojourners in the land, especially when they are working for the Israelites. As you move forward through the chapter, you look at verses 15 to 22, and we see the command to kill every son. In these last few verses, we see that when the Israelites continue to multiply and spread despite forced labor and oppression, Pharaoh first tries to have the midwives kill the sons as they are being born. Then when this doesn't work, he orders all his people, presumably all the military and official personnel, to throw any son born to the Israelites into the Nile. There are a few things to note here as we consider what's going on. The first thing is seen in verse 15, and it might be something that we just read over, but it is very striking if you take a moment to think about it, especially in the ancient context, and that is the power of names. If you read verse 15, the king of Egypt, or Pharaoh in some contexts and other verses, that's all we ever read about this Pharaoh. We are never actually given a name. But the socially and culturally speaking, the very lowly Hebrew midwives, both of them, are named. especially in the ancient world, but even still today, names have power. Preserving, honoring, and remembering a name, especially in the ancient context, was extremely important and extremely powerful. It is how one preserved one's reputation, and they even viewed it as preserving an essence of themselves. And essentially what God is saying by not preserving the name of that Pharaoh is that because of his choices to be in direct opposition to God, he does not get that honor. But these Hebrew midwives, because they were on God's side and chose to fear and honor him, as we'll see in these verses, their names are preserved and protected. And during their life and for all of eternity, they're blessed. The same is also true, by the way, of the next Pharaoh, who we also do not get a name for. But we get lots of names of all the people who are faithful to God throughout this whole book. The next thing to consider is the word that is translated birthstool in verse 16. And I bring this up and you might be just like, what? Why? Why are we focusing on a birthstool? Like I said, there's a lot of furniture stuff in the book of Exodus, so just bear with me. If you read a few different translations, and I don't know how many we have represented in the pews here, but if you read a few different translations, you will see that this verse is translated actually various ways. It is because there are a couple difficulties in the Hebrew that the verse, that the translators are trying to iron out and make comprehensible as best as they can, according to how they understand how it should be read. The first problem is that the word often translated birthstool or stool is actually the object of the verb see. So the translators add in them to make the sentence make more sense, rather than translating it as when you see the birthstool or look on the birthstool. They add in them so that when you look on them on the birthstool or them on the stool. But another problem is actually that the word translated birthstool means stones, bricks, or potter's wheel. It is the same word that we get from Jeremiah 18 in the potter's wheel when God is talking to Jeremiah and talking about how he works in the world. Another problem comes from the reaction of Pharaoh to the midwives not killing the boys. We know that he's very cruel and bent on exterminating the male population of the Israelites, so it seems strange that he does not seem to punish them for saying that the child is born before they get there. It seems that he would have expected them to kill them anyway. Taking all these problems together, I think it is helpful to realize that Pharaoh is the one using the phrase, look on the stones or the potter's wheel, and also to realize that potter's wheel, or look on the potter's wheel, or see the potter's wheel, is actually a fairly well-known Egyptian religious metaphor for the process of child development in the womb. So I think there's a good argument to be made, that it's at least a possibility, that Pharaoh was asking them that when the midwives check on the mothers and do a prenatal exam, that if they're able to determine that it is a boy, that they abort the boy. There is actually historical evidence that in this region at this time, they had multiple ways of determining the gender while still in gestation, and they also had multiple ways of aborting. So putting the fact together, the grammar difficulties, and also Pharaoh's reaction, that he doesn't just expect them to kill them anyway with follow-up care, I think it's reasonable to argue that he was trying to be a little bit covert with this one and just have the Hebrew midwives abort the child during the birth. And that's why once the child is born, they're no longer held to what he's asking them to do. So basically what they're saying is like, look, we came for a prenatal exam, but the baby's already born. These Hebrew women are giving birth early, before we even felt like we needed to be there. And then because it is viewed as an abortion, he's pretty much letting them off the hook at that point. And this also explains why his next step ups the ante, and then now it's after birth, that all of his people, if a son has been born, kill it. So he goes from pre to post birth. The last thing to consider in this section is simply the irony that the very water used for Pharaoh's order of death later becomes the source of deliverance when Moses is found and rescued by Pharaoh's own daughter, and that his chosen means of execution, water, also becomes the very means of death for the next Pharaoh and his army. Here, in this context, we see that every son was to be cast into the Nile. And then later in chapter 14, verse 27, we're going to see that the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. I don't think that's on accident that that wording is very similar. It's also another irony that it was Pharaoh's daughter who took Moses out of the water. and then she paid Moses, we'll get there, she paid Moses' mom to take care of him. Guess where that money came from? Pharaoh's household. So there's just so many layers of irony that's happening there. And speaking of that, in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, which is our last section for today, we read of the birth of Moses. So starting in 2, verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank, when his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done with him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant women, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew's children." Then his sister said to the Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call on a nurse from the Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." In this account, we see that Moses' mother, technically, obeys Pharaoh's command, but on her own terms. And while doing so, in a way that as much as possible would preserve Moses' life to the best of her ability and leave the rest in God's hands. And then we see God work from there. Pharaoh had commanded that every son be cast into the Nile. So Moses' mother technically put him in the Nile, but she put him in a basket with his sister watching nearby to see what would happen. And then Pharaoh's daughter sees the child and takes pity on him and then ends up, like I said, paying Moses' mom to take care of Moses until he was old enough to go into Pharaoh's household. This is where I have a side note about the Prince of Egypt movie, which kind of destroyed a really beautiful scene for me, because you have the scene of Moses' mother putting him in the water, and then the basket just like goes and does this like tremendous journey while his mom's singing this gorgeous, heart-wrenching song. It's an amazing scene. It's very beautiful. But if you actually follow what's happening to the basket, she puts the basket in the reeds. The Pharaoh's daughter comes and sees the basket in the reeds and then takes it out. Like, the basket doesn't go anywhere if you follow the events of the story. So that's just a side note if you've seen The Prince of Egypt recently. But back to the story here. Pharaoh's order is overturned by his own daughter, who lifts Moses, the future deliverer of the Israelite people, whom her dad is trying to exterminate through getting rid of the male population, is overturned by his own daughter and out of the very water meant to kill him. And then Moses' own mother is paid with money from Pharaoh's own household to raise him. God's sense of irony is just amazing in how he takes the plans of the enemies of God and uses those very plans against themselves. In this section, we also see, just as I pointed out in the first few verses of the theme of God continuing to keep his promise, we also see that even here, we see a theme of recreation and the continuation of God's plan. The ESV says that Moses' mother saw that he was a fine child. It's kind of unfortunate that they use the word fine, because the word is the same word back in Genesis 1 that is used a lot when God sees what he has made and says it is good. It's the same exact word. And then the word for basket is also the same Hebrew word that is used for the ark that God had Noah build and through which he saved Noah and his family from the flood. So you have a purposeful drawback to creation and then also to the flood. We see that even in the midst of these terrible times, through the faith of this woman who doesn't know how this is going to play out, that God is still continuing his plan. This is also seen even back in verse 1. Getting back to the first few verses that I talked about, it's seen with the phrase, "These are the names of," which seems to us to be a cue to skip what is coming because it is one of the boring genealogies. But one of the things to pay attention to with genealogies is to notice where they fall in the storyline of Scripture and notice what is going on around them. If you'll notice, Genealogies often serve as a drumbeat at the very times that seem the darkest to remind us that God's plan is still advancing. This list of names keeps going and going and going. God's plan is still going and going and going, despite whatever opposition the world is bringing against it. This is also seen in the comment in verse 12 that the people, despite opposition, multiplied and spread abroad. It is also interesting to note that the concepts of brick and mortar that they were building the store cities with and then spread abroad are paired here. The only other place they are paired together in the Bible is at Babel. At Babel, the descendants of Noah disobeyed God's command and spread abroad and instead built a tower through brick and mortar to make a name for themselves. Despite this, God caused them to spread abroad by coming down and dividing their languages. Here, Pharaoh has the people build cities for himself, but God continues to cause them to spread and later comes down to strike the Egyptians so that the people are allowed to leave and go to the promised land. In these first two chapters, we see a purposeful, continued, repeated, and multifaceted theme of the continuation of God's plan, despite everything that is happening. We see that the people are fruitful, multiplying, and spreading abroad despite opposition. We see connections to creation, the flood, and Babel that remind us that the same God is still present at work to protect and deliver his people. And this leads us directly into our application for today. God will be faithful to his promises. Even when all seems lost, even when there hasn't been an answer, or even a whisper, even when things are darker than they have ever been, God will still fulfill his promises. He is faithful. He will not abandon his own. And we will see that his ways are greater than our own. The Israelites were in Egypt for about 400 years. God had led them there, but it undoubtedly felt that he had abandoned them there. And they groaned for a deliverer. Then God raised up Moses. Later, in Israel's history at the end of the Old Testament, God led some of his people back from exile and into the Promised Land. But in another period of about 400 years between the last events of the Old Testament and the first events of the New Testament, things did not go well, and they eventually found themselves under Roman rule. They again groaned for a deliverer. And this time, God sent a new and greater deliverer, his own son, to save all of mankind from their greatest enemies, sin and death, from separation from God. They thought that he had come to save them from Rome, but he came to save them from themselves. They thought that he had come just for the nation of Israel, but he had come also for the whole world. He has promised to come again to right all wrongs and to stop injustice, for he is concerned about these things. But for now, he calls us to faith, hope, and love in whatever circumstances we find ourselves. We might need the courage of the midwives to stand up for what we know is right. We may need the quiet, faithful confidence of Moses' mother to do the best she could with what she had and to leave the rest to God. They had this courage, they had this confidence, because they knew then what we can still know now, that God is faithful. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you for this season. I thank you for the reminder that is still as true today as it was in the time of this book, as it was in the time of your son's birth, that you are faithful, that no matter what this world can do, no matter what plans this world comes up with, you take those very plans and you turn them on the enemy, that your promises will be fulfilled, that you will never abandon your people, and that we can trust you. I pray all this in your name. Amen.